Welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. Welcome to the program, A Good Book. This is the fifth part of the book, Late for the Bus, An Adoption Story, Finding My Birth Parents, Jerry and Joanne Buss. I'm your volunteer reader, Lee Close, and I am also the author of the book. This is the true story of finding my birth parents after years of fruitless searching, only to discover that I am the eldest daughter of Dr. Gerald Buss, the multimillionaire, legendary owner of the Los Angeles Lakers, and his wife, Joanne. From the previous broadcast, we stayed in Phoenix for the third year in a row and saw the benefits by getting a new 1963 Ford Falcon station wagon and being able to fly for free to California on Bonanza Airlines. 1963 also brought another move back to California for fifth grade, with November bringing the tragic assassination of President John F. Kennedy and also our family's bankruptcy, along with the restaurant burglary, and then another move back to Arizona for sixth grade, and my favorite school and my favorite teacher so far. Continuing now. Our backyard met the far end of the school playground, separated only by a dirt path. There was no fence to keep us out. Whenever the grounds were flooded with irrigation water, the neighborhood kids would bring a round piece of plywood, about 24 inches to 30 inches in diameter, and we would go skimboarding by spinning the board flat across the water, running to catch up with it, jumping on it, skimming across the shallow water that covered the grass. We got soaked and itchy in the muddy, slightly smelly water, but we didn't care. It was fun. My best friend, Joy Lynn, was a tomboy with golden red hair, freckles, and a big smile. Her little brother, Rusty, always wanted to be around us, and that was fine with me. I didn't think there was much of a chance that I would ever have a little brother, so I borrowed hers. There were sleepovers at her house, and the three of us would eat popcorn and watch movies on television. The next day, we would swim in her doughboy pool. My blonde hair turned platinum that year from all the sun and chlorine. Chapter 3. Middle School, summer of 1965, back to California. This time, I dreaded our summer move, but it happened anyway. Back to California. Moving meant no longer having a best friend, knowing you had to start all over again finding one. If I put up a fuss about leaving, Mom would say in her calm and reassuring way, "Well, you can make a plan, but you can't make the plan." Across the desert again, into California and onto Interstate 10, including our regular stop at Denny's in Blythe, where my parents would sit and smoke and drink coffee until I was ready to go and start the car and drive off without them, except they had the keys. Finally, back on the road, we would approach the city of Riverside, usually around dusk. The towering street lamps that hovered over the freeway, when lit, gave a deep yellow cast to the damp, smoggy air, which felt like the beginning of a scary movie. Christine stayed behind in Arizona for part of her senior year at Alhambra. This time, I didn't feel the usual excitement of being an explorer in a new land. No one knew how it happened, but our beautiful Chinese checkers game was accidentally left behind in Arizona. We couldn't go back. I know it broke Mom's heart. I began to question why we continue to move back and forth, back and forth. Was it a tug of war between my parents? Who loved Arizona the most? Who loved California the most? Each time we settled, it was easy for Mom to find work, no matter which state. Not so easy for Dad, who no longer worked for Western Stockman. We ended up in Southgate again, this time in an apartment near my grandmother. We had just gotten settled in when 3 miles away, just before my birthday in August, the Watts riots began and racial tensions shook the nation. Hundreds of buildings were burned and lives were lost. At night, you could smell the smoke from the fires, and in the mornings, you could run your finger over tiny bits of ash that settled, along with the dew, on the hood of the car. The riots only lasted a few days, but that short moment in history felt like a very long time to me. 1965, 1966, seventh grade, Southgate and Covina, California. My school year began in a fog. I was enrolled at Southgate Junior High, a big industrial-looking building with a blacktop playground, no grass. It felt like a prison to me. Because of the summer riots, many of the schools in Watts had been closed, and hundreds of students were bused to our school. Feelings were raw and the atmosphere touchy. One day in the girls' restroom, I entered the stall right next to a black girl who had just closed her door and hung her sweater up over her stall. As I was opening my door, I noticed that two white girls had grabbed her sweater and thrown it on the dirty, damp floor of the bathroom and stomped on it. Giving me a stare, they walked out laughing. I picked up the sweater and hung it back up on the stall door. I am sure the girl was too frightened to come out. I never got to see her face, but I felt so sad. It made my stomach queasy, the way you feel when an elevator goes down too fast. I didn't want to go to that school one more day. I just wanted out of there. I wanted to go back to Arizona. I don't remember any of my classes or teachers. None. Blanked it out. Even though I got to watch the Dodgers win the World Series again with my uncle, I still wanted out of there. We did move a few months later, not back to Arizona, but to Covina, California, about 30 miles north and east of Southgate. We rented an apartment on Vecino Drive. I enrolled mid-quarter at Sierra Vista Middle School, a nice new school, with wide open spaces, including a center gathering area, with a curved half wall built of concrete brick covered with decorative color tiles. The atmosphere was pleasant, the complete opposite of Southgate Junior High, for which I was grateful. My sister joined the family in Covina to finish her senior year at South Hills High School, a fairly new school up in the Covina Hills. Back in Arizona, she had rekindled old friendships at Alhambra High and was not happy about having to move again midstream. She was also upset having to share a bedroom with me. She wanted her own space. We fought over inconsequential matters more than once. One day I came home from school to find that she had divided our room in half by lining it with masking tape, down one wall and across the carpet. She was serious. My bed was closest to the window, so I had to tiptoe across her territory to the doorway to get out. I don't remember the duration, but we got over it somehow. She didn't want much to do with me anymore. Some days, the feeling was mutual. South Hills High School wasn't all bad news for my sister. A nice young man took her to the prom. She wore a pretty lavender satin dress and wore her hair teased, complete with a purple velvet bow to match her dress. She looked beautiful to me. She had taken some modeling classes and one day hoped to be an airline stewardess. Almost 18, she was growing up fast. I would celebrate my 13th birthday that summer, but I was tall and lanky and still very much a tomboy. I only saw my mom cry once. I'm not sure if this was the reason, but Dad was still not working. She and I were in the family car, a gray 1953 Dodge, a big car with felt-like bench seats. Mom pulled over to the side of the road and began to sob quietly, but only for a few moments, her face in her hands, leaning on the steering wheel. As quickly as she had begun crying, she stopped, looked over at me and smiled. "What's that behind your ears?" Puzzled at her question, but before I could say a word, she reached behind my left ear and pulled out a piece of new bazooka bubble gum, still in the wrapper. Total surprise. She had never done anything like that, and before I knew it, we were back on the road again. Summer of 1966, Covina, California. I was so happy that we did not move that summer. I could look forward to going back to Sierra Vista Middle School for eighth grade. Christine graduated in June from South Hills High School, class of 66, and wanted to go to college, but she was told there was no money, so she immediately moved to Southgate to live with our grandmother. Fresh out of high school, she started working at Jim's Burger Joint on Tweedy Boulevard. She recently wrote to me, "I remember during my senior year, I wanted to check out colleges, but they said they didn't have the money for me to go, so I didn't bother to visit colleges at all." After my sister left home that summer, I joined a skateboard club and purchased a new fiberglass skateboard with my birthday money. It came with a lifetime guarantee. If anything broke, I could take it to the Vitapact Orange Juice Company in Covina for repair or replacement. When I relay this story today, no one can conceive of such an arrangement, but it is true. I was given the nickname Little Surf by my skateboarding friends, and even though we lived nowhere near the Pacific Ocean, I wore a leather anklet that was supposed to keep the sharks away. My skateboard specialty was the coffin, by which I would get down and lie on my back with my hands in prayer position while the skateboard was in motion. On the weekends, my friends and I would skateboard in the cement washes behind the apartments and then go to the local liquor store and buy hot tamales candy. I love skateboarding, but I can't even stand on one now. Not sure where that talent went. I missed Arizona, but nothing beat the Southern California summers, 15 to 20 degrees cooler than Phoenix in the daytime. Perfect skateboarding weather. Perfect anything weather. Mom had gone back to work at the Hofbrauhaus restaurant and didn't have time for hobbies, but she loved anything with mystery attached to it. Through the years, we often played a game called Table Up. Four people would sit at a card table and place their hands flat on that table, with thumbs and pinky fingers stretching wide. Then everyone would start chanting, "Table up, table up, table up." And after a few moments, you couldn't tell if you were saying "table up" or "up table, up table, up table." The mesmerizing chant continued until one leg of the table would slowly rise up a few inches. Then you could ask a yes or no question. If that table leg lowered once, the answer was yes. If it lowered twice, then the answer was no. Mom was always the game leader, and if she was somehow able to cheat, I never figured it out. On July the 4th, my parents went out with friends from AA. My sister was already in Southgate. Fireworks were legal in California, but not in Arizona. So I was excited about the purchase of a dozen sparklers at a fireworks stand. After my parents left for the evening, I thought it would be fun to test them in the dark. I took a couple out of the box and lit them with a match and turned out the lights. Sparkles everywhere. So pretty. But soon the living room got real smoky and bits of fire went everywhere, landing on the gold-colored carpet, burning tiny little holes in it. I turned the lights back on, opened the door and windows, and spent the rest of the evening with one of my father's double-edged razor blades, slicing off what seemed to be a million little black burnt spots on the carpet. No one ever guessed I had performed such delicate surgery on a holiday. You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Lee Close. Dad's involvement with AA was increasing. When I went along with Mom and Dad to the meetings, I sat in the back of the room, away from all the smoke, near the big aluminum coffee pot and the empty coffee can for donations of loose change to help pay for the coffee. I'd watch my dad walk up to the podium and begin with the familiar, "Hello, my name is Jim, and I'm an alcoholic." He was an eloquent speaker, and several people would bring cassette recorders to tape his talks on one of the 12 steps for that evening. Although I wasn't paying attention consciously, in time I could recite many of those 12 steps by heart. 1966, 1967, 8th grade, Covina, California. For 8th grade, I continued my schooling at Sierra Vista Middle School in Covina. I was grateful for the breather. Moving back and forth felt like a never-ending roller coaster ride, and as a teenager now, I was beginning to resent the instability in our lives. We stayed in the same complex on Vecino Drive, but moved to a different apartment. At least it wasn't another drive across the desert with a trailer in tow. Dad got a job as a security officer at Jet Propulsion Laboratory. He wore a dark, grayish-blue uniform and carried a gun, which seemed really weird to me. Mom continued as a waitress, and they both tried their luck at selling Stanley Home products for a little extra cash. Mom sold enough product that year to win a vinyl raincoat printed to look like a mink coat. Each time she wore that coat, I wanted to hide. For Christmas, I always got Mom a box of See's candy, dark chocolate, soft centers. I usually gave Dad some nondescript present, but this year, I decided to draw a copy of the Serenity Prayer on parchment paper. Using a fountain pen with black ink, I drew fancy Gothic letters and added decorative corners, all hand-drawn, no stencils. I was so proud of it. I finished on Christmas Eve and showed it to Mom, but before wrapping it, I realized I had made an error. The fourth line read, "Courage to the things," but it should have been, "Courage to change the things." Mom told me not to worry, go to bed. It was late, and Dad would appreciate the gift. On Christmas morning, as he unwrapped it and read it, I told him I was sorry I had goofed it up. No, it's perfect, because when you make a mistake, all you can do is say the prayer. That was my dad, my biggest champion, right or wrong. I have the prayer scroll now, and as I was writing this book, I noticed I forgot the word "the" on the fifth line, just before the word "wisdom." Dad's words still ring true. Just say the prayer and smile. Thank you, Daddy. Life was always smoother when both Mom and Dad were working. Sometimes I wasn't quite sure where I fit in the mix, but when they were happy and relaxed, it made me happier too. My best friend Cindy was an only child from a divorced family. Her mother worked full-time. Cindy and I would walk home from school together and watch Dark Shadows, an afternoon soap opera with vampires on television. Cindy's mother was an alcoholic and hid her alcohol everywhere. One day, Cindy went searching and found a bottle of Cutty Sark scotch in the clothes hamper. We decided to drink some. Probably too much. We refilled the bottle with water and put it back in the hamper. I walked home, went upstairs, and threw up in the toilet. To this day, if I smell scotch, I get nauseated. Summer of 1967, Covina, California. Is there anything more exciting than graduating from eighth grade? My dad gave me a Webster's Dictionary and wrote on the inside cover in his exquisite penmanship, "Words are powerful. Learn to use them wisely." My friends were with me the whole day, and we all got ready together for the big event. I tried to copy my sister's hairstyle by teasing the top of my hair with a rat tail comb and putting a bow in it. It looked awful. I couldn't get it combed out in time either, so no pictures of me exist at graduation. After commencement, we all hung out on the school grounds. My pretty floral autograph book was signed by several teachers and friends with the usual short sentiments. My best friend Cindy took up several pages. She wrote, "Hey man, I guess you could say that we've been through a lot together this year. Both good things and bad. Can you dig it? It's been different from all other years. We've been a lot of places and done some really groovy things. Humor, that I think is the base of our good friendship. We have a weird one that nobody else understands. But I dig on it, and I hope we can go on with it for a while. We have a long, hot summer ahead of us. Let's try to make it bitchin', okay? Think of the guys, baby. I mean, we're really flying high now, and I hope it lasts for a long time. But will it? I hope you're in some of my classes next year. But even if you're not, I mean, who cares? Who cares about anything, right? Danny, I don't know him yet, will I? Remember the bitchin' gang? Remember the vampire? Love, Cindy." Well, Cindy did get to know Danny, my first serious boyfriend, and she stole him from me at the beginning of our freshman year. Probably a good thing, as he was 17, a dropout, and had a motorcycle. That summer, without a care and no helmet, I rode 30 miles on the back of his motorcycle from Covina to the Teenage Fair in Hollywood, 15 of those miles on busy Interstate 10. That same day, Danny gave me two gifts, a burn on the inside of my lower right leg from hugging the hot chrome muffler, and a hickey on the left side of my neck, both of which I hid from my parents with liquid makeup, hoping they wouldn't find out. I had the freedom to explore, even at a young age, as my parents believed in setting few boundaries. "Roots and wings," was my mom's favorite saying. 1967 was the summer of love in Southern California. You could feel it, especially in the music. My graduation money was spent on albums. Rolling Stones' High Tide, Bob Dylan, Blonde on Blonde, and Beatles Revolver. Monaro was $1.95 per album, $2.95 if you wanted stereo. My record player got a workout that summer, and so did I. My friends and I had a blast. Now it was my turn to grow up fast. Chapter 4, Trial by Fire, The Teenage Years. Quote, "All the world is made of faith and trust and pixie dust." J.M. Barrie, Peter Pan. 1967, 1968, ninth grade, Covina, California. We stayed in the same apartment on Vecino Drive, 3 years in the same school district, but another new school. South Hills High School would be, by far, the ritziest school I would ever attend. Spacious. Immaculate grounds. There were 5 different levels of freshman English classes, and I placed in the highest. Our brilliant teacher would recite a poem in Middle English at the beginning of each class. I loved hearing her speak this interesting language. She taught freshman English as though it were a college course. My childhood experience as a Catholic spurred me on to take Latin as my foreign language requirement. I joined JCL, the Latin Club, and was so proud of the pin I had received. Academically, I was above average, but I was also hanging out with the wrong crowd. The rich kids lived up in the hills near the high school, far away from Interstate 10. Those of us who were not lived on the other side of the freeway in the lowlands. It was both a physical and sociological barrier. I caught a ride to school every day with one of my parents, but after school, I was on my own. By the time I finished the 4-mile-long walk back down Barranca Avenue, my eyes were red and teary from the smog, and I could feel it in my lungs. Occasionally, my friends and I would stop at McDonald's first and then hang out at the park nearby. Hamburgers were 25 cents, and a cheeseburger was 29 cents. I missed the clean air of Arizona. Covina was bad, but the smoggy air was even worse in Southgate. Nearly a decade earlier, while my grandmother was visiting Texarkana, Arkansas, in October of 1959, she wrote a letter to my mom that began, "Hello, everyone. We sure are enjoying this smog-free air." P.S. That's not a typo on the word every. Grandma's southern dialect remained intact all of her days. The discussion of politics was always lively in her house, and you could sense that I was right in the world when the Democrats were in office. Except for this year, 1968, when the assassinations of Martin Luther King in April and Robert E. Kennedy in June in Los Angeles jolted my parents, especially my dad, who always winced when Grandma would say that she liked George C. Wallace for president because he was so good looking. Oh my goodness, that's all the time we have for today's broadcast. Please join us on the next program for the continuation of Late for the Bus, an adoption story by Lee Close, author of the book and your volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.